Welcome to Into the Nuance, compassionate, evidence-based pre-med advising. Join us each episode as we unravel the complexities, debunk myths, and explore the many paths to medical school. Whether you're a freshman or a pre-med veteran, we are here to provide informed, realistic, and hopeful advice on your journey. Tune in for interviews with experts, stories of triumph, and useful tips as you continue towards medical school. This is Into the Nuance, and we are so glad you're here.
Hey, pre-meds. It's me, Joanne Snapp, and I'm joined here by my friends, Amanda and Doug. We're here for episode 3 or 4 or 5. I've lost count. Where are we at, guys? 4. Awesome.
Three or four.
One of I can say I'm not good with numbers. I hope you guys are good with numbers. I am excited to be here. We're going to talk a little bit, get into the nuance again about lots of things. Today, we really wanted to talk a little bit about MCAT dates and scheduling, rescheduling, when is it too late, and maybe even a little bit about boundaries, because we are all facing similar things. We were chatting before, and we realized we're facing some similar challenges with some pre-meds these days. So we're going to get into that. Did I miss anything?
I think we're ready to get started.
Awesome. So we were talking before about when should you, you know, when is the latest we should take the MCAT, especially, you know, for those applying this spring. If you're not applying this spring, you can take the MCAT, you know, no rush. This doesn't apply to you. If you are applying this spring in 3 months, when is the latest you should take the MCAT before it causes any problems? So I know what I would say, but I want to hear my MCAT expert friends say first. What do you all think?
So for me, I always say it depends, which I guess is our theme of our podcast, right? Is that it depends on your situation. My hard line for latest to be safe and comfortable has been based off of the programs I've worked with, where I have most programs say that mid-June is the latest that they're comfortable having students take the MCAT. But at the same time, I've seen students take the MCAT later in the summer and also get interviews in the fall. So I think the important thing is to make sure that the timeline works with the other parts of the application you have going on, because it is so tough to do the MCAT simultaneously with your application work. And so I think that's the bigger challenge, is how do the pieces line up in your calendar versus any particular end date where it's like a go, no go situation.
Yeah.
I agree. I think ideally I like to see my students taking it for the first time and hopefully the last time in January or March. But as far as the latest goes, again, I think I usually default to like end of May, beginning of June. Just again, to make sure that, you know, it kind of dovetails with the time it takes to get your application verified. So if you do submit right on June 1st, it's going to take some weeks to get verified anyway. So, you know, it's not going to slow anything down if you get your score back, say mid to late June, really, you know. So, and there's also that myth that if you don't submit on day one, oh, there's no chance of getting in. And so like, that's just way overblown and it's not really true. So, there's some leeway in there. Usually if we're going to have to wait until say August or something like that to take it, August, September, then you have to have that difficult conversation of like, is this really the year to apply? Well, what Amanda said is true. I've seen people do it. It just always gives me nerves.
A little anxiety. Yeah, like, it's not easy for us.
It's really going to work. Oh my gosh.
It's hard for us, right?
A difficult conversation of like, maybe there's some other things you could do in the meantime and just put off that application for a year until the next cycle, and that way you're not as well. I mean, they're also stressed out trying to take an MCAT late in the cycle, and that's not going to make their score any better, being all kind of stressed out. So,
yeah. Well, I think the most ideal thing would be to take the MCAT in September before you're applying, right? The whole mm-hmm. year, so that you have that extra year in case you have to repeat it. So, 100%, if like you're planning to take the MCAT in September, my first thought is like, oh, just wait a year. Like, what's one more year? One more year makes such a difference when it comes to being successful. It's one more year of work experience, one more year to, you know, boost your MCAT up. Like, that's going to make such a difference in your success. But in the larger scheme of things of life, one more year is nothing, right? Like once you get in your 40s, I guess, 40s, I think we're all in our 40s.
Not 43.
30s
through 40s, you realize that in your 20s. Yeah, I've never once, and you guys can tell me if this is an untrue statement on your end, I've never once had a student who ended up in medical school say, you know what, I regretted taking that extra year. Like I've always had students be like so grateful to take that time before go, you know? So yeah, totally agree there.
Yeah. So right now,
the surprise I hear the students that get in after that extra year and go like, oh my gosh, I'm like the youngest person in the class. Like even after you waited a year, you're still saying I'm the youngest person in the class. That's telling you something. Like people. Yeah.
Well, that's because 24-year-olds think they're old and it just cracks me up. I don't even have when they start telling me they're old at 24. I'm just like, I can't relate. So I'm being asked every day, you know, it's that time of year where I know, Amanda, you were saying a lot of people are you're prepping a lot of people for a March MCAT and same people are talking to me, right? And they're freaking out because their scores are dropping on their practice exams. And so they're coming to me, should I push my test date? April, May, or June? They're asking me, what should I do? Mm-hmm. April, May, or June? And I'm like, well, number one priority is doing well in the MCAT. Because mm-hmm. if you don't do well in the MCAT, then it really doesn't matter when you apply, right? So do well in the MCAT. So the question is, which month is going to give you the best score? Yeah. And I know my first question is, what else have you have going on? Like, are you graduating in June? I know you're prepping your app. That's going to take a lot of time. Are you planning a trip in any of those months? Are you getting married any of those months? You know, anything going on during any of those months where it clearly is not a good fit for the MCAT? I think that's the first question I always ask is there anything that's going to keep you from doing well? And if yes, then don't pick that month.
Yeah. My first question is, because for me at least, you know, I'm actively working with students on their MCAT prep. And so it often comes off of a score drop or a score plateau, right? Where we're expecting to see that score increase happen in a practice exam. It doesn't, and we see a drop. And then they're like, I need to move my testing. And the first question I always ask is like, do we really, is that data accurate, right? A scaled score tells us almost nothing about the test experience. It really doesn't. And so I really have students go through, I actually made a YouTube video about this because I literally had the same conversation probably 15 times last week, where score plateaus are normal, score drops are normal. This is not linear in terms, like we wish that the MCAT scores would just go up 3 points every practice exam, but it doesn't. And so I go through a process of why did that happen, right? Why did the score plateau happen? And if you were sick and didn't sleep well that day and you were in a distracting environment, that's the reason our score dropped, is that a good enough reason to even move your test date in the first place, right? So making sure that the data is actually accurate to like, okay, am I struggling with my prep? Or was this just one data point, right? I don't like making decisions off of a single data point for my students, especially when we don't need to make decisions. So what I do, I don't know if you do this, Doug, but I make them put in their 30-day, 60-day, and 10-day deadlines for their exams for rescheduling as soon as they schedule their exam. And that's when we make decisions. It does not make a difference whether you move your test date 45 days out or 31 days out in terms of cost. So we don't always have to make that decision in that emotional moment. We can wait for a few more data points is usually how I start the conversation.
That's exactly right. Getting those dates in your calendar to know when you have to make those decisions is more useful than like reacting emotionally. Because when you react in fear, you're going to make not necessarily the right decision. And you could get the right decision, but you're more likely to be basing it on incorrect information. And I mean, it also depends on the tests they're taking. Not all practice MCATs are created equal.
Totally true.
And so, you know, there's even within the AMC, the gold standard, quote unquote, of all the practice tests, there's some variability and difficulty on those tests, or there's some variability in the content that's covered on those tests. So maybe you didn't cover what was on that particular test that day yet, because that's still a little bit further down the road for you, but yet it was on an earlier test. So, and then the next test, it's going to be all stuff that you're familiar with. And so the score is going to vary from that. And then if you take a different company's test, take like a Princeton Review or a Kaplan or a whatever test, then you're going to see differences there. And not to get into like the whole thing, those tests, by the way, are not like made to be intentionally more difficult to make you want to do their courses. I can say from experience that was never in our minds when we created those tests when I was working for that one company. And, you know, it was never like, ooh, excellent. We're going to make these tests impossible students. So we'll get some new students in there. But it was, you know, there's style differences. Like, right. And you're going to see style differences on the real test. When you take that one, there's going to be different people that wrote that test versus the people that wrote the AMZ materials. So people are always surprised on every test. And that's actually good. That's why I actually do like students to take more than just one company's tests.
Agreed.
Like take different ones because that's the way it's going to feel on test day.
Yeah. The ones that I always recommend, I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on this too. So I've always told people to go and buy Altius's test prep. They sell tests outright. I think Princeton sells them, UWorld. Who else sells just the test?
Blueprint's my favorite. And I'm biased just because I'm data junkie when it comes to looking at student scores. And the reason I like Blueprint the most is not because they necessarily have a better exam, but they have a really data heavy review interface. And so students can see like down to like how long they spend on each question in a graph form. They can see the AAMC codes of the foundational concepts that match up with the AAMC exams. They can see, you know, compare and contrast between AAMC. So that the only reason I use Blueprint over the other tests is I think they do a better job with data presentation and they're pretty and they're graphical. And I think it makes it more enjoyable to review those tests. And that's really what the practice exams are for, in my opinion. They're not to get a score. They're so that you learn. And so having an interface that allows you to learn, and certain students prefer different, you know, different interfaces. And that's why it's great that there's options, because certain students love, you know, a different like Kaplan or Altius or Princeton Review. And they just enjoy that interface. And that's great. You know, find the thing that works. I just personally, as somebody who's very, like, I like to make decisions off of data, I love having a plethora of data to work with.
And the Blueprint tests show the timing way better than any of the other tests out there. I think that's the linchpin for me, is Blueprint shows the time spent per question, where you can dig for that info with some of the other ones, but it's not as easy to find. And so, and then just for the record, UWorld doesn't have tests. They only have practice questions. There's just a Q bank.
But they're a great Q bank, you know? So, yeah. So I think that's the thing. It's like, to Doug's point, there's a lot of variety. So depending on the test you took, it's hard to say, did I do better or worse without doing a deeper dive, right? Like just looking at the scaled score, even between AAMC tests. And if anyone has, you know, listening has taken multiple AAMC tests, you can get the exact same scaled score at a totally different percentile and a totally different number of questions correct. So it's really important to dig into that data and be like, did I actually get more questions correct? And I just got a worse scaled score, but I did improve in the areas I set out to, right? And kind of doing a deeper dive. Because again, like what they've essentially done with the MCAT is it's a scaled binary test, right? You get it right or wrong for a non-binary skill and process, right? Learning science is not binary, but they're testing you in a binary way. So you have to kind of do that backwards assessment to see if you've actually improved.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I used to, when I was a young advisor, I used to always ask people, how do you feel after you take the test? How do you feel after you take these practice exams? I stopped asking those questions. I think that was a total waste of time. I don't know how anybody's feelings have any predictive value. Do you find that to be true? Like how someone feels about their practice test has any link to any success or not success?
I actually think it's usually inversely related most of the time. Funny, I just was talking about this in a class I was teaching last week, was the Dunning-Kruger effect, where people generally that do fairly well in their testing experience will assume they did worse. People that do generally rather poorly in their practice tend to think they did better than they did. And people that kind of are average ability, like they're doing average on their tests, they are usually ones that can pinpoint how they do, but very few people are in that average zone. And by the way, Dunning-Kruger effect has nothing to do with Mount Stupid and the Valley of Despair, all those diagrams and crap you see on Reddit that like make jokes of it. That's a totally different thing. Please look up the actual research on the Dunning-Kruger effect, because it is not what you think it is.
Yeah, and it can come up in PsychSoc, so a little content area there. The other thing that I actually do like feelings, Joanne, because I think it helps students realize, because on their real test, right, on your real test, you don't get your score back for a month. All you have are your feelings. And a lot of students will make decisions before they get their score back based on those feelings. And I want them to know, are these feelings accurate or not? And we can tell that based on how accurate they are in practice. So an exercise I like to do is I like to have students pause their test after each section early on in their prep, because it's not representative, it's a real test, and just take 5 minutes to write down how they felt that section went. So after Chem Phys, I'll have them pause and be like, I think I did this, I think I did that, you know, that was terrible, I don't know why I'm trying to do this, right? Whatever it is. And then before they finish the PsychSoc section, see their score, they pause and they write an overall feeling, and then they see their score. Because as soon as you see your score, your mentality changes, right? If you thought you did really well and you see a low score, all of a sudden you're like, well, no, I actually felt like I did terrible. Like, you know, there's an immediate change. And so seeing what they actually wrote about each section can really help you see, like, okay, am I accurate with my abilities, or am I being subject to the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Where it's like, I'm either overconfident or underconfident in certain areas. So I love doing that in practice too. I'll be like, pause this, how do you think that passage went? Pause this, how do you, and it just helps them kind of calibrate to a more accurate sense, so that when they are in their real test and they have a rough Chem Phys section, they can say, you know what, it always feels rough and I do okay. So this must mean okay too.
So that's great. I love hearing that about the, I'm glad that you all do that when you're doing your MCAT prep. I find that in the post MCAT, post, you know, that period between taking the test and getting your score back, where it's just like, I mean, it's such an anxious time and there's no control anymore, right? There's nothing we can do. You're past the point of voiding, you know, there's no point in rescheduling until you have your new score. And it's just this, like, this really intense time of just waiting to hear back. I think that's the period where I'm like, we're not going to hover in those feelings right now, because they have no predictive value. Like, we can't do anything about it. But it's funny you say that, I love that. Like, I love that you're helping them align, like, you know, is my anxiety valid? Sometimes maybe it is. Maybe they can actually feel if they don't do well. But I wonder how many times they feel really bad about how they did, and then it turns out their score was fine.
Mm-hmm. And then it's cool, because it's like, all right, well, my emotions can't be trusted, so I've got to just hope that I did my best. And you know, I think that I often joke, but I don't think it's a joke, that the month after your exam is harder than studying. Right? Because you've done what you can do, and you just have to feel that anxiety.
Well, it really is. It's like, yeah. It's equivalent to the, like, once your secondaries are done.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to say.
Kind of thing. You got nothing to do but wait.
And check your email and be anxious.
Stop checking your email. It's not going to come any faster.
Yeah.
Score's going to get to you when it gets to you.
Yes. And one of the things I like to do, and I'm sure you guys do this with applications as well, is we do a test day game plan. You know, what are you going to do on test day? And then I always make them write, what are you going to do for fun after test day? How are you going to celebrate that you've completed this? And the way I kind of frame it is, it's more like graduation, right? In graduations, you're not thinking about your grades. You're just proud that you graduated. And that's how I want students to feel after they take their MCAT. Like, you did it. You did the thing. You've completed the thing. You get to celebrate the fact that you graduated from your MCAT prep, at least at this stage. And you should celebrate, like, go do things that you haven't let yourself do because you've been studying, or see friends that you haven't seen in a while because you've been in a study hole, and trying to make it feel like there's a completion point before the score comes back.
Yeah, we were talking about that at one of my Tuesday night meetings a couple of weeks ago. One of the med students who I had come on said that she planned a cruise, right? And like, she set a date, she said like August 15th, let's say. And then that basically was the date by which she had to have her secondaries done, because there was not going to be internet. So she had to have them done. It really helped her focus to get them done. And she had something to look forward to. So if the only thing to look forward to post-secondaries is fear and anxiety, I don't see why you would want to hurry up and get them done, right? You need something exciting to look forward to. I love that idea. And I know not everybody can afford a cruise or a trip, but even if it's something simple, like a weekend with your friends or going to the beach, just pick a date and say, this is the date I'm celebrating the completion of my application process. And, you know, it's all done at this point. I gave it my best. There's nothing more I can do. And I'm going to take a big, deep breath and be done. And I can imagine that would feel really good.
Yeah. I also, and I wonder if you both have this experience too of like, sometimes my student support system needs a little coaching, because a lot of times, and I'm sure this happens even more in applications, but a lot of times they'll come and be like, you know, my parent or, you know, my mentor or my friends keep asking me about my MCAT prep or how I thought my MCAT went. And it's just causing me more anxiety. I know they're trying to be nice and supportive, but like, it's just making me more anxious. And so do you guys do any like how to coach your support system parts of your process?
What do you do?
Sometimes it's just like, you got to teach them that they can talk to those people, because sometimes they like, it's parents. You don't talk back to your parents. You listen to what they say, but you know, you got to explain to sometimes the students that's just, you have to be able to talk to them. You just need to do it, because that constant, and what it ends up being is the student looks at it as nagging from parents, it's going to damage that relationship potentially. Even like, just open that door and actually have a frank conversation saying, I know this is coming from a place where you're meaning well, but it's not helping me. You just got to like help the students understand that conversation isn't going to go poorly, or as poorly as they think it will. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's also not just parents, it's significant others. It's aunts and uncles. Say again? Yes.
It's the coworkers at the lab constantly. Yeah. Have you heard back yet?
Okay. Yeah, other pre-meds in your programs. Yeah, Joanne, especially like for applications, which I imagine is like such a, like, it's such an agonizing thing to go, it's, you know, like at least the MCAT, like, you know, when you're getting your test score, I think like applications is like even worse. So do you have any advice for students that you give for the support team?
Last year, a student of mine kept asking me, she's like, will you please host an event for parents? And I had never done that before. And I did. I hosted a workshop one evening, and I invited everyone to invite their parents. And I ended up having about 10 parents in the room. And many of them, I mean, it ended up being a really productive conversation. You know, some of them you could tell were just really unaware of the process. And I broke everything down and explained it. And I got a little pushback on some things, but for the most part, by the end, everyone seemed to really appreciate having a better understanding of how it worked. And I think that probably is where it's stemming from, is they don't know how to help you. And all they know is what they've heard from their friend, so-and-so's daughter got in, and this is what she did. And so they're just operating on very limited knowledge, and they want to help you, but they just don't know how. And so I think if you just really clearly share the information with them, you know, share a recording you have of someone explaining it, you know, it could be me, share the timeline, explain to them with information, you know, published information about how it works. And once they understand conceptually that it is not likely that you're going to hear back from a med school by October, you're not going to know where you're going, you know, for sure by November, that it's not done by December. You know, if they understand that up front, then they know that there's no point in asking you, that you say, you know, as soon as I hear something, you will be the first person to know. I will text you the minute I hear anything. Same with your friends. You know, I've had people who've gotten really upset talking about their colleagues at work. And I've always said that, you know, clinic spaces, research labs are some of the most toxic spaces for pre-meds because of that, like, perpetual, like, oh, I got 3 interviews. How many interviews have you got? And I got this score. What did you get? And da-da-da, just constant comparison. And I've told people, you know, just first of all, it's just like any kind of harassment. If you want it to stop, you have to literally ask people. You have to say, you know, I'd really prefer that we not talk about this at work. Can you please stop talking about this in front of me? And if they don't respect you enough to do that, then you're going to have to physically remove yourself from that space. You're going to have to say, when you start talking about this, I'm going to leave. And they'll get the hint.
Yeah. And I think that is kind of the difference, right? There's a difference between like your support team, who is genuinely there and they just want to help and they don't know how. Right. And then and I think what you said, Joanne, is perfect. Like for that crew that you have, that like, you know, they love you and they support you and they're just trying to do the best they can to support you. The more information they have about how to do that, they just want to know how, right? So like what I do is I'll have students write out a script to tell their family and friends for after they take their MCAT of like, hey guys, like I'm taking my MCAT on Friday. Here's what I'd like you to say to me. Like, congratulations. Don't ask me how it went, or like, don't say anything until I bring it up. But whatever it is, like, here's how you can support me the best after my MCAT is over. Because 95% of the time, that's all they want. But then there are people who really are not there to support you, right? And that can be family and friends, unfortunately. It can be coworkers, it can be classmates, where it's a little bit more comparison, and maybe they're going through the same process and they want to feel good. And so talking it up is a big part of their process. I always like to think about Hermione and Harry Potter, who like to go over her exam results, even though everyone knew she did her best, like she did the best. And it's like, no one wanted to hear that. And so her friend said, you know, Hermione, don't talk about exam results after our test. And I think that's really important. And I honestly would say the earlier, the better. Like if you know you have colleagues who are going to be going through that application process with you before you even get there, just be like, hey, it's important for me and my mental health to really separate work and application. Like, I would really love it if we just had a general rule that like, we don't talk about pre-med, like before it even happens. So it doesn't become an altercation, you know, it can be really helpful. So it's tough though.
There's also self-moderation that has to happen there too, because like, you can't delete the internet. You can't delete Reddit. You can't delete Student Doctor Network. You can't delete TikTok. Well, I mean, you can delete TikTok. But, like, you've got to keep yourself from jumping to those places to say, like, what are you, you know, like, keep checking in on those things all through that time of, like, waiting for your score to come back and being convinced, like, oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to compare to this person. Because that's probably literally the most toxic place you could go in for most people. And yet you do it anyway. Like, why are you reading this stuff? What, you know, it's bad. Stop reading it. And it's hard though, because they're like, that's a lifeline. Like I can rely on these people that are going to tell me what they did. And, but like, those aren't the right people. A lot of times, like there's not all, it's not all bad on Reddit and Student Doctor Network, but there's enough bad that you got to keep yourself from going there and getting yourself anxious and making it even harder on yourself. I literally have a student right now who sends me a message like every 3 days, like clockwork, because like, it's like, it seems like talk them down on day one. And then 3 days later, they've been back on the internet and been getting more and more anxious. So like 3 days comes and like, oh my God, what am I going to do when I get my score back? Cause I know it's not going to be good enough. Or let's talk you off the ledge again, but like, stop going on the internet. Stop doing it. Cause it's just going to be the cycle every 3 days.
One of my students said just this last week, she's like, I know I shouldn't, but I have this masochistic urge to get on Reddit. And it's like, it is, it's self-harming. It's hurting you, right? Like, there's very rarely a situation where students are going on there for a specific useful purpose, right? It's often to like, be like, how do I stack up next to these internet strangers, which is never going to feel good.
Yeah. And you know, they're not telling the truth. A lot of that stuff is just completely fabricated. And I know this because, so when I worked at a medical school, I was the admissions lady. I was the one who ran the days and did all the admissions presentations for the interview days. And of course, like I would go on SDN every day at the end of the interview day and track and see what people just said about our day, our school. And I swear to you, so many times I was quoted as the admissions lady said, blah, blah, blah. And they would say things I did not say. Like I said nothing like that. And I was being quoted. And then what do you think happened? It sent people into this huge frenzy. Oh my God, well, if she said that, what does that mean? You know, people were saying, I said, you know, oh, you're interviewing for the wait list, or you're doing, you know, just really, you know, ridiculous stuff. Did not say it. I'd have to go find medical students to go on there and fix it and be like, that's not true. Like that's, you know, but it was so blatantly wrong. And then I lost all respect for the platform after that. Because it's not moderated. People can do anything they want. I think there are probably some sociopaths on there who just like to get people messed up, stirred up, bad.
There's also money involved because I know this is a fact. I'm not going to say how or why I know this, but people are paid to be trolls on Student Doctor Network back in the day to say certain things to certain about certain people and places and companies and stuff like that. Intentionally to smear. And so like that's a real thing on those websites. So yeah, that's It's more than just like anxiety, like mistakes. It's also intentional. There's some
malintent. Yeah.
So that is straight up happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's just like, you're right. Like there's like a small bit of good, but the harm outweighs the good most of the time. So I think our advice to listeners, I think all of us could agree, is like stay off the SDN and Reddit. It's just not worth it. If you need your questions answered, like that's what people like us are for. Like we'll give you some nuance, we'll give you our perspective. We won't say that this is the truth. We'll say that this is our perspective, you know. And I think like talking to real people, right? Not people behind an internet anonymity.
Yeah, and it's more than SDN and Reddit. It's also YouTube. It's also TikTok. It's these places where lots of people record their interactions and like talk about them on the internet and through YouTube videos even.
Yeah.
Seeing people misrepresent things in their YouTube videos unintentionally, and you know, and then it creates messaging from that point forward.
The reason I don't get, you know, when I see somebody on Instagram or YouTube spouting things that I don't agree with, you know, and someone comes to me and says, hey, did you see that? Whatever. I try not to say, oh, that person is wrong. Usually I will just say, you know, everybody comes to their own truth based on their own lived experiences. And I don't know how that person got that truth. I won't know because I'm not going to ask them. I just know that that's what they think for some reason. Now, if that makes you feel bad or icky in some way, that means that that person's not your person, right? Like, just don't listen to them. It's okay. They can think that. And we all have our own truth. So find the person whose truth makes the most sense for you. You don't have to listen to every person, right? There are so many medical students now on Instagram who are advising. And I think that's great that they want to help people and they're giving away all this information for free. I love that, except their truth is only based on their own acceptance. Mm-hmm. They're only a person. They haven't looked at hundreds of people. They've only known their own experience. So I know they want to help, but at the same time, like you can't base what's going to work out for you on their lived experience.
Right. Yeah. And I think that gets into kind of how do you find the right support? Right. Like, and that's both about holding boundaries, like finding the right support team and then kind of staying away from those toxic people that, you know, are just, you know, maybe they're in your world and they're also going through the process, but they may not be the best people to listen to or talk to about this stuff. Similarly, like on the internet, there are certain people that I'm sure are great and provide like resources without providing biased or like opinionated advice, right? Where it's like, here are just some resources and those are great. You know, I'm trying to get up in my YouTube game a little bit. And I even worry about that of like, oh, what if I say something? You know, I try to be really careful not to be like, this is definitely going to be on the MCAT or definitely not. Because I've been teaching the MCAT full time for 5 years and I can't say that with authority. I don't know for sure if this will definitely be on an MCAT because we don't know, right? Like there's just a limit to our knowledge as coaches. And I think, so I guess I would say like, when you're considering if somebody is trustworthy, see if they self-qualify, right? If they are like, you know, if they're like, hey, so this is my experience, or like, this is something that could happen. But if they're using extreme language, just like in cars, right? Yeah, just as in cars, you want to stay away from the extreme answer choices, also stay away from extreme advice givers, if that makes sense.
Also works in science, by the way.
And it works in science too. Stay away from extremes. Yeah.
Extremes are never good.
I love hyperbolic language.
Yes.
Yeah, no, if it feels gimmicky, it's probably gimmicky, right? And if people are promising you anything, I would run in the opposite direction. Like I'm pretty good at my job and I can say most people I work with get into med school. I will never promise you will get into med school. Yeah. It is very hard to get into med school. I don't know if you guys promise certain scores, but I am not going to sit here and promise anyone that I can get you into med school. I will tell you, I will try my best. Yeah. I'm honest about that.
I have an ethical issue with score guarantees, which I know is like probably a controversial statement a bit because a lot of companies do it, but I feel like it's ethically wrong to say, hey, you know, purchase this course and we're going to guarantee you this score, because it's not true. Like there's no way a coach, no matter how good they are, can guarantee a student's score. They're not the one taking the test for them. And they're not the one going through the process and the learning, and they don't know where their that student's baseline is. So to say that you're going to guarantee a score and then guarantee a ridiculously high score just feels borderline unethical to me, which again, like, I know that that's probably the most controversial take I have on MCAT prep, but it just, it's bothered me. It bothered me as a student. It bothers me now as a coach because it's just not true. It can't be true.
So if you read the fine print, they're not guaranteeing a score though. And that's the thing. And they don't guarantee a score. They guarantee you can retake their course and have access to their materials until they can attain that score.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not like, and that's how I think I agree with you 100% that I think the guaranteeing score is insane. You can't do it. You there's no way, because you can't guarantee that a student will be able to perform at a certain level. That's like saying, I guarantee you this team is going to win this game. Like, no, you can't do it. So but like the workaround is the fact that they're saying, hey, we're only going to let you do this again and again and again until you decide you're not
right.
That score and make it very difficult to do that.
Yes.
The student I had a few years ago who used that company, I think they all know we're talking about, that has that score thing. The way they got around it was they said, okay, in order to get this score, you had to do X, Y, and Z. And they had a whole, you know, dashboard. X, Y, and Z was so beyond realistic in terms of what a student could possibly get accomplished in a week that as soon, and they tracked the hours they were in the site. And as soon as they hit that, as soon as they failed the very first time, you didn't satisfy our requirements, it was boom, guaranteed lost.
Yeah. I will say,
we're not talking about one company anymore.
Most companies do.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, the issue I have is less the, I mean, you know, unfortunately with these kind of guarantees, it's kind of like car salesmanship, right? Where there's like all this fine print. I do have an issue with that too, from like a sales perspective. My bigger issue with the score guarantee is that by saying that score, right, that very high score that is guaranteed, that kind of sends messaging to all students that that's the score that they need to hit to get into medical school. And that's the other issue I have, is like that score is not realistically attainable in the timeline for most students, nor is necessary for them to be very successful in there. And so like the whole vibe of like, you're not going to be a med student unless you have this score, and we're going to promise you that just by showing up to my program, you're going to get this score. Like that whole vibe just feels like it's at best, it's just like, we want them to achieve the best they can. But at worst, it's kind of, setting them up for failure. Yeah, it's like kind of like this, like, I'll never achieve this, so why even try? What I want to say to students is like, when students meet with me and they ask, I get this question probably every time I meet with a student, is like, do you have a score guarantee? I say no, because your score that you need to get is going to be different than any other student's score. And we need to figure out what that is first. So I can't guarantee a specific score. And two, you're doing the work. You've got to guarantee that score for you. Like, I can guarantee you that I'm going to give you my very best support, and I'm going to give you my honest assessment if you're on track and all of that stuff. And I'll support you through retakes. Absolutely. But I can't guarantee your performance. Only you can do that, you know? And I just think like that's the ethical language with test prep, is that like the students are doing the work, and to promise them that just by signing up for a course, they'll get the results kind of makes them feel like, oh, no matter what, I'll get it. Which, like, no, you got to do a lot of work. You got to do a lot of work to get to your goals. And it's not about the course. Like, to be honest, I don't think that there's necessarily that big of a difference between my course and another course, as long as you've done the work, right? And you can commit to it. So anyway, that's my soapbox.
Well, and the scores that they come up with are coming from, like, what I think we would all agree is not the way you want to be thinking about admissions anyway, which is, let's look at the average scores for schools. And like, you don't need to have the average score to be competitive, which I always hate that phrase anyway. Because as long as they're looking at your application, you're competitive. So you just got to have above what they will look at. And so those scores are artificially high for that reason too. Like when you start looking at MSAR and saying like, oh, the school X has a 515 average, I have to have a 515 so I can get to that school. No, you don't.
Scores have nothing to do with being competitive. I've had people with 499 MCATs with 9 interviews, and that person was competitive. And people who have 510s with no interviews, and obviously they weren't competitive. So competitive, it lies way beyond the scores. And I think that's the type of pre-med mentality that I hope in my lifetime to shift even just a smidgen, just a centimeter, to help people realize that it's not your numbers. I mean, I'm glad we have Amanda and Doug helping you with the numbers. Yes. The numbers are important, but you know, the better you do, the less stress you're going to have and the less concern the schools will have about you, but it doesn't guarantee anything.
I say this every single time. I got a 520. I didn't get a single interview because I didn't have an awesome Joanne telling me that, hey, you didn't do any clinical work. Maybe you don't apply this year. And so a lot of students would assume I, like, regardless of my application, with a decent GPA and a 520 MCAT score, I would have gotten an interview, right? Nope. Not a single one applied to 22 schools. So I say that to tell students, like, I'm here to teach you, like, my whole job is MCAT, and the MCAT is not all that in the world of, like, which is why I think, to circle back to our conversation at the beginning of this, like, the timeline for the MCAT is really about, like, doing what's best for you in your timeline. Get it done. Do the very best you can. Make sure that it's not taking away from really important experiences or opportunities that will really shine in your application, including writing your application.
Yep, I agree. And you can't wait till the last minute to do these things. So if it's like 1 month before your MCAT, you know, you can't track Amanda and Doug down and ask for a miracle at that point. It's just not going to work. Just like coming to me in May telling me, you know, oh, I want you to help me build this amazing application in 1 month. Or I've had people come a week before and they're like, I want my app submitted in a week and I need you to help me get that done. And, you know, when you bring that type of, like, really anxious energy to us, you know, you would think, oh, we're just going to match it and just be like, yes, let's all, like, rally and get this done in a month. And honestly, as a professional, I don't feel that way. I feel like you had the same amount of time as everybody else. Why are you waiting till the last minute to start this? That to me either screams you're irresponsible or you're self-sabotaging. Both are sad at this point because you should be ready to go. I'm not saying if you come to me in May, I'm not going to help you. I'm going to help you get it done, but I'm going to be not very thrilled about it. I'm being honest. I mean, I know, Amanda, what do you think when people come to you a month before?
Yeah. The problem is I can't, I always feel terrible about this, but there's just me, right? It's just me doing all my coaching, and I book out 4 to 6 months in advance for individual coaching. My courses are booked out 2 months in advance, and it's because this process takes a long time. And, like, the minimum I request students to study for is 10 to 12 weeks because it's not easy to get done. And it's stressful to try to smush it in. You can't cram for a standardized critical reasoning test. You just can't do it and can't expect a miracle. And even if you can get it done, even if I have had students say, well, my friend studied for a month and got their score. Even if it's possible, it's not always going to set you up for feeling very successful about the experience, right? Even if you perform okay, you may always think, like, what if I could have done a little better? If I had prepared a little bit more or done the things a little bit more ahead of the timeline. And so what I usually say is, like, I wish I could help you, but I want to put my best effort into helping students. And that takes months to really provide the kind of care and support that I want to do and I want to provide. And I don't want to give a subpar experience for students. And rushing just feels icky, right? Rushing always feels icky when you're studying. Cramming feels terrible. And I don't want that experience for me or the student, right? It's not fun. And it's very rarely successful. So, and then we just come back to that same conversation we've talked about earlier, which is, like, does it really have to happen right now? Right? What is this timeline that you've created for yourself? And is it actually real? Or is it just this previous version that you've now, like, held on to that's no longer realistic with your life?
That's a great way of putting it. Doug, what do you think? You're going to help someone last minute?
I will probably, like, say I would turn you down. I would even say I can't even work with you a little because it's not in your best interest. Like, honestly, it's not. Number one, for me, it's more of a waste of time to me of, like, if I'm going to invest in a student, I want to invest in somebody who I think can be successful. And so depending on what you're asking me to do, I'm going to make that choice of, is it worth it to me to invest my time into you? And I know, like, you're paying me to get this help, but at the same time, my time is also valuable, and I don't want to, and your time is valuable. I don't want to waste your money. I don't want you to pay me something that's not going to end up, you're investing in it too. And if it's not going to be an investment that pays off for you, there's no point. And so I find it unethical, in fact, to just say yes to everybody because, you know, if I don't feel like I can help this person in the timeline that they have, then I, you know, it's not worth your, it's not worth the money they're spending on. And I feel bad taking their money, honestly.
Totally. It's one of the reasons that Joey and I love your company name, My Honest Advisor. Cause I feel like part of our roles as being honest is like, you know, like I've had students come to me that were like, hey, I have to retake. And I really wish the person I had worked with or the company I'd worked with before told me that this was unrealistic, because that I went in unprepared. And I wish I'd been told that my plan was not going to be successful. And I do think that's true. Like, our job is to tell you how you're going to be successful. And sometimes that's a tough conversation where we have to say what you have built in terms of a timeline, in our professional opinion, is unlikely to be successful. And we want you to be successful, so we're being honest with you about that.
Yeah. I agree. I typically take the route that you guys are talking about by about July. If someone's coming to me to submit their start their primary from scratch in July, I usually will say, I'm not the right one for you. I don't think that this is going to work. And I agree with you. Like, I think it's unethical to take people's money when you know it's probably not going to work out. So I think we've covered a lot today. And I think that for a lot of the people who are taking the MCAT in the spring and they're already working with us, I don't want to stress anyone out. I think you guys are all fine. You're all doing great, and keep doing what you're doing. Keep working hard. Try not to let the stress and the anxiety, you know, psych yourself out and stop studying. Don't do that. Just keep pushing. Keep seeing Amanda. Keep seeing Doug. Keep seeing whoever you're working with. But don't stop, and don't lessen, because, you know, if you could take it earlier, the better. I know it's so tempting to just reschedule it for May, June, or July. That's the easiest thing to do if you're stressed out. But if you don't need to, I would say take it earlier, get it over with, because, you know, by May, June, July, you should be done with Doug and Amanda, because then I own you, right? Like, we're doing secondaries, baby. Like, it's going to be fun. We're all writing all summer long. You don't want to be stressing about your MCAT when you're also stressing about secondaries.
I will say, I know we talked about, like, a lot of this anxiety comes from score plateaus and drops. And I built a YouTube video, so that is on my YouTube channel, about how to determine if it's a genuine score drop or if it was just a situation. So if you've recently had a rough practice exam and you aren't sure whether or not to keep going or to maybe reschedule, check out that YouTube video. I tried to give kind of the, like, how to make those yes, no decisions.
All right. Anything you want to add, Doug?
So podcast is probably going to come out after the February 27th, but after February 27th, if you do need to reschedule, I know we don't necessarily want to reschedule in fear, but if you do need to reschedule, that you're going to have some options for the later spring dates, because there's going to be a lot of rescheduling to the summer. So just know that registration opens for July through September on February 27th, or it did, if for future people. And so that just means we're going to see a lot more open up in that, like, April slots and May slots, probably going to start becoming more available if you do need that one extra week or one extra month or something for a good reason to move it. So it's okay to move if you have to. And sometimes it just waits to be patient, or it makes sense to be patient.
Yeah. Keep checking that registration portal.
Yep.
All right. Well, it was so fun hanging out with you guys today. We covered a lot of really good content, and we'll be back with more. We'll be diving into the nuance about your med school application and MCAT prep. I can be found at myhonestadvisor.com and on Instagram and YouTube.
And I'm Amanda Brehm, and you can find me at bremmethod.com with two M's, or on YouTube at bremmethod.
I'm Doug, and you can find me at icosaprep.com. That's how you spell it right there.
All right. Have a wonderful week, everybody.